From the banks of the Grand River, high above the gorge, this is the Buzzer Pod. New releases, industry insiders, out-of-the-box conversations, indie music. With guests from the True North, from the West Coast to the East Coast, and across the pond and down under. Now, here's Shay.
Hey, Shay here, On Air Indie, Episode 7. Welcome and enjoy. It's February the 2nd. Today in 1959, Buddy Holly, Richard Valens, and the Big Bopper played their last ever gig. They appeared at the Surf Ballroom, Clear Lake, Iowa. They died in a plane crash the following day, the day that music died in 1959. Our guest is indie folk songwriter Ali Aslam, based in Brooklyn, New York. Ali gets real about his debut album, The Last American. The Last American is an acoustic collage of stories about growing up, straddling the Pakistani culture of his family and the American culture of his peers. Anyone who has ever felt they don't quite belong for any reason will relate to this show. Welcome, Ali. How are you today?
I'm doing well, Shay. How are you?
I'm doing great. Did you have a wonderful holiday?
I did, yeah. I had a very pleasant pleasant break.
Oh, that's good. Always good to have a break. Your debut album, The Last American, is getting great reviews, in particular Vents Magazine and CurrentMusic.com. They actually said it was a beautiful exploration of sound, which I agree with. Is there any other nods to the album that you can tell us about?
Yeah, the Dancing with Architecture had a really great review that just was lovely written. And then I was just featured in Rolling Stone India yesterday as kind of an artist to check out and a record to check out, which, you know, was a little bit of a surprise for all of us. But you know, we're grateful for the coverage for sure.
Yeah, Dave Franklin of Dancing About Architecture wrote a great review, and he actually said that your songs are really about America and of the world today. How do you feel about that?
Well, that was the line that really kind of touched me. You know, we had this like thesis about what we were trying to do, right, and who we were writing for, and you know, you can have a lot of ideas about what you're doing as an artist or what you're doing for a project, but for then, you know, someone else to listen to your work and sort of pick up on all of those intentions or so many of those intentions, it's really kind of gratifying. And so I'm very grateful for that review.
Well, he wrote an excellent review. I couldn't have written it any better. So in terms of music, were you always drawn to music? Was there a certain event or happening that drew you to music?
Well, I would say I've always been drawn to music, but I didn't have the opportunity to be a musician until a bit later. It's a little bit of an interesting story where I graduated college. I studied architecture, and I graduated right in the kind of first few months of the recession, and there's no work for anybody, but there was especially no work for architects, right? Because nobody was building or investing or developing, and so there was just a lot of time, you know. And I went to a New Year's party, or actually I don't remember what the occasion was, but I went to a party at a friend's house, and he had a bunch of band gear in the basement. You know, he had a drum kit and a bunch of guitars and amps and things. So I just asked him about it. It's like, oh, hey, cool, you have a band? And he's like, yeah, I do. But we don't have a singer. I'm looking for a singer. And I said, I'm a singer. Which at the time was an absolute lie. I'd never been a public performer of any kind. You know, I sang in the shower, but not too loud because I didn't want anybody to hear me.
Funny story.
But here I am with a lot of time on my hands, and my friend has a band and he needs a singer. And so now I'm going to be a singer. And he says, great, go home and send me a demo. And now I'm terrified, right? Because I have to, one, figure out what a demo is, and two, record one. But, you know, like I said, I had a lot of time on my hands. So I went home and I recorded a demo of me singing, and I didn't like any of it. And so I kind of called him back and I said, you know, have you guys composed anything? And so he sent me a link to a couple of kind of instrumental things that they had been working on. And I wrote a few songs for those pieces. And I kind of came to their next rehearsal and performed them. And they loved it. And that was kind of my in. Into sort of becoming a musician was actually through songwriting, before anything else.
Do you still perform with that band, or are you mostly a solo act?
It's mostly a solo act now. That band, I'm still in touch with all of them, and I love them. But you know, that was sort of right out of school, and you know, we were all kind of still kicking around, but. Over time, you know, economies improve, relationships change, and, you know, kind of people move in different directions. So that band kind of broke up. But then all of a sudden I was a singer and a songwriter without a lot of musical skills under my belt. So the road to becoming a solo artist is a little bit of a winding one because, you know, I had to kind of learn how to compose in different ways now, right? I had always kind of had a band to communicate with and people to lean on, and now all of a sudden I didn't. But I was still writing, and I was still kind of coming up with melodies and coming up with songs and lyrics. But I didn't have a lot of guitar skills. I didn't have a lot of piano skills, so those had to kind of, I had to pick those up. I had to learn how to do that before I could, you know, truly call myself a solo artist.
So you taught yourself as an adult.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I came into music mostly as an adult, and kind of backwards if you think about it, right? Like I was a front man in a band and having a lot of fun, and we made some great music that I'm very proud of. That band was called the New Bedfords, and then, you know, I find myself kind of improving as a writer, and then not having all the tools I need to kind of keep this craft going, and so yeah, I'd written all these songs, and I would perform them a cappella. You know, I would show up to open mics and perform a cappella. And then I kind of slowly found some compatriots who could teach me. And then, you know, I could learn whatever else I needed to learn. To learn how to play the songs that I'd already written. So yeah, I definitely came into this as an adult and very much with the intention of creating the project that's out in the world now.
So is your future dedicated to music, or are you still active in architecture?
No, I'm still an architect, and I love that. You know, every career has sort of a winding path. And I think I'm at a point now where I have a lot of clarity about what it is that I do, especially on the architecture side. And so the way I frame it is that, like, I am a storyteller. And I have two different medium in which I carry out that craft, right? So I'm a storyteller, and I get to do that in architecture as a designer, and I get to do that in music as a songwriter, a singer, and now a recording artist.
Yes, both are creative mediums, like you say, and both creative endeavors, and I can see why you're successful at both.
Well, thank you.
So what influences, you're welcome. No, I actually enjoy listening to your music. It's very soothing.
Well, thank you. I have every intention to.
It creates thought, you think about it. Keep doing it. when you were growing up, was music around you, and did any of that spill over into your music, or was something that you were the first of the flock to become interested in that career?
Well, I would say music is always around us, the way it is in a lot of households, right? Like, you know, you've got the radio, and you've got the music that your family, your parents are listening to, or your siblings are listening to. But I would say that context is a little different when you are either an immigrant or you know what I am, which is a first generation American. And so what I mean is, like, the music that I absorbed like a whole history of American music, kind of all at the same time. You know, my dad came to America in the 70s, and I was born here. And so what that means is, you know, I didn't learn about the Beatles from my dad when I was a kid going through his record collection. He didn't have one for me to dig through. I learned about the Beatles when I was in college, at the same time that I was listening to Jay-Z, at the same time that I was discovering, you know, the new New Jersey punk band. And so, like, all of those things kind of meld into the same context, which is sort of how I've always experienced music, or kind of popular music. At the same time, my dad is a poet. He's an Urdu poet. He performs Shayari, which is how you'd refer to that.
Your dad's a published poet?
He is. Yeah, he's a published poet. He goes by the pen name of Aslam Sadaf. He has a book of Urdu poetry, and, you know, that's always been a part of my life, and it's beautiful. And, you know, Urdu poetry is mostly spoken. And so there's a rhythm and a cadence to it that's sort of the most fundamental part of how Urdu poetry is structured. And so that's always been kind of around me. But no one would have called that music until I started making music, I guess.
Your album, The Last American, is a collage of stories about growing up and straddling the Pakistani culture of your family in America. Would you like to highlight one of the tracks or two?
Sure. Let's see. I think the easiest thing, you know, there's a few. I would say Wise Man and the Fool is very much about straddling cultures. Seasons Change Without Permission is a little bit about my relationship to my dad. Brave is definitely about straddling cultures. Photocopy is about being an outsider and kind of looking in and kind of trying to understand your own role in a culture or not. Rebel Song is definitely about that idea of just sort of kind of deciding whether or not you can live your own truth and what that means. Refugee is, you know, just this story about what it means to leave home, you know, and I think that's a perspective that wasn't necessarily being told in the story of kind of, you know, Muslim refugees or refugees of really any kind who are kind of fleeing strife or poverty and kind of coming to this country. So I wanted to write a song about that. I think there's a way that you can construe all of these songs to be a little bit about that divide.
So you identify your music as supersonic folk.
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit about that? Is this a new genre?
Well, it's a descriptor that I think applies and is evocative of the sound that we're creating. I think at the heart, these are folk songs. And, you know, it's important to me that these are American folk songs. There's a lot of reasons for that. But the first is that, like, in the U.S., American folk is very, it's very white centric, you know, and it's about an Appalachian tradition, and it's about guitars and this whole kind of like stomp and holler Americana thing. But in all other art forms, folk it's about, you know, sort of self-taught art, right? And it's a way for people to ennoble their own lives. And so from my perspective, you know, this is a first generation American, someone who's kind of been asked to be an outsider or sees himself as an outsider, staking claim to that title of American folk. But because of that context of what the rest of American folk is, it requires a little bit of qualification. And so this is getting back to what I was sort of talking about earlier, where you kind of synthesize or you experience music a little differently when you're an immigrant or when you are a first generation American, right? Your context begins when your parents arrive, or when you first arrive in this country, or when your story begins in this country, right? So for me, the sort of musical context in which I'm creating folk music begins in the 70s through to today, but it's all experienced at once. And we were trying to synthesize that perspective into a sound. And I think some of it we succeeded in, and you know, others can judge whether or not all of that comes across. But that's what we were trying to do in this kind of profile of music. And so there's a certain swagger that guitars have, and then there's synthesizers, and there's funk, and there's R&B, and kind of all of these things that are sort of happening at once that we were trying to tell a story with.
Your music has been compared to Bruce Springsteen. Is that a misnomer? Because I can see it.
Oh yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, I adore Bruce Springsteen. Yeah. I mean, there's mythology in music, right? And Bruce Springsteen is one of those kind of mythological characters in pop music, and he, you know, he has this ability to tell very small stories in absolutely huge epic proportions, right? This, like, he changes the scale of your life in the midst of a song, and so, you know, discovering Bruce Springsteen was a huge moment for me, and he's definitely he remains a big influence, and I'm perfectly proud to have grown up in New Jersey and claim him as my own.
Are there other artists?
U2 was a big influence for me. I kind of rediscovered music. There was a period when I was a kid where I actually didn't listen to music at all. And then kind of early in high school, U2 had released All That You Can't Leave Behind, and I loved that record. And I heard it on the radio, and I had to go buy it, and I loved that record. And you know, that was sort of like a way back into music. But then, you know, there's Tegan and Sarah, who I adore, as you know, they're just, I think they're some of the best pop writers on earth. And if I ever get to work with anybody, I'd want to work with them. And then there's, you know, growing up in high school, there was this whole kind of culture of New Jersey punk bands, the Gaslight Anthem. And then as I got older, I kind of discovered Motown, and there's Marvin Gaye and Michael Jackson and the Jackson 5. That is like, those are my touchstones, I would say. The Killers are a big one too. Those are definitely my touchstones. It's all about this, like, the scale and the cinema of it all.
So we're coming up to listen to your first track, Color of the Sun, that was released October 2020. Can you tell us what the story is about? A love song or in inner turmoil about a situation?
Yeah. So this is a song where I you know, when I play this live, I kind of say that this is a little bit of this is my worldview. You know, this song is a synopsis of my worldview, which is I want to live in a more compassionate world, and I acknowledge that compassion is very hard. we're hearing. And that's really what the heart of this song is about. I had, you know, my road to becoming a kind of solo act, a solo musician was a little bit winding, but I had found myself in a community of songwriters in New York. And you know, there's so many wonderful songwriters in New York City, whose songs have the power to just carry you, you know, through whatever it is you happen to be going through. And so there's people, around me whose songs I had lived in. And in some ways this song began as a tribute to them. And ultimately, like, in the recorded version, the lyric that references, you know, these other songs was actually cut just because it made the song a little bit more focused. But it began in this kind of recognition that, there's a lot of borrowed courage, in other people's music. You know, someone can sing a song and it can get you through a moment. And this song was sort of acknowledging that I'm taking that from other people and I'm grateful for it. And in spite of that, you know, I find myself lacking in achieving this thesis of wanting a more compassionate world, because it's really hard. And so when we removed that reference, I think it became a lot more focused. And so what lives on the record is this, you know, kind of lament about wanting to be better and recognizing that you're always failing at being better. But wanting is a big part of getting better, right? So that's what this song is.
Ali, can you give us an introduction to the song Color of the Sun?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I have a friend who says, there's two kinds of songs. One is poetry and the other is bad journalism. Bad journalism being, you know, this is just something that happened to you. And this song is actually, it's bad journalism disguised as poetry. And by that, I mean, you know, there's a bridge in the song that says, there's a ringing in my ear that just won't go away and it keeps me awake at night. And that's a reference to, you know, I actually have pretty severe tinnitus or tinnitus is how it's pronounced, which is a persistent ringing in your ears. And that goes back to an injury that I had. I was once again at a party. It was a 4th of July party this time. And someone threw one of those, you know, those little like gunpowder snaps that you throw at the ground. You get them at 4th of July parades and they make little popping noises. Someone threw one of those at my head and it blew up near my ear. And from that moment on, I've had this ringing in my ears, which for anybody who has this will recognize that this can be a very, very stressful condition. I also have fairly significant hearing loss in my left ear. So,
well, that's an awesome introduction to the track. We'll come back to talk to Ali about his hearing loss and how it affected the music that he's just put out. So now we're going to listen to Color of the Sun.
I want for all of my habits to be sung, how fragments of all the people I have loved, and not some strange inheritance from some lost relative so far removed from. Oh, all I've done, yeah. Oh, if you only knew the color of the sun that I see when I close my eyes, I'd be blind to the world till the madness is gone, left unnamed to the turn of the tide, 'cause I can't hold it in my head. I can't hold it in my head. I have the heart. And I won't know the names of the people you lost in the wars you fought on your own. And I won't know the sting of the love you forgot that hit hard in the stories we told. And I won't know the fear in your feet as you walk every night to a place called home. I can't hold it in my head. You're hurting my head. I can't hold it in my head. But I have the heart to try. There's a ring in my ear that just won't go away. And it keeps me awake at night. Is it something that I hear to remind that I need to forget myself sometimes? Oh, I know what it is to pray for better luck, to hope against the pride. I would be by your side when you're coming with stuck, and that's still.
To have your hearing affected would be very challenging if wanting to create music.
Well, so that was the challenge, is that for a long time, I didn't think that I could continue on my path as a musician, because I was worried that I couldn't hear, you know, the truth of whatever it was I was doing. I had to reevaluate my voice, right? Because I couldn't hear my own voice the same way that I had previously. Because it wasn't just the ringing, but the hearing loss itself, right? Because I lost certain frequencies. So the sureness that you have in a pitch is no longer what you remember it, right? So you have to kind of relearn all of that kind of muscle memory. You know, being a songwriter and kind of always looking for meaning in things, you know, it took me years to get to this song, but I sort of liked that idea that, like, you know, the things that you care about are hard won, right? And if what I care about is wanting to be better, and wanting to be more compassionate, then maybe this condition, this kind of constant pain, is a symbol, and I can use it to whatever I want it to be, right? And so now it's a symbol for me, as just a reminder that I'm not the most important thing in the world, and that I can care about other people. So,
you did an event last Christmas on December 25th. It was quite a collaboration with other artists.
Oh yeah. So this is an evolution of a tradition that I have. So I'm Muslim, and my family doesn't celebrate Christmas per se, and we don't really have a holiday this time of year. But for as long as I've lived in New York and had friends in New York, I've always known that there are people who find their way here, and around the holidays, you know, either by circumstance or by choice, aren't able to go home, or unwilling to go home, or for whatever reason are kind of orphaned on the holiday. And so every year I would host, you know, a Christmas dinner where I'd decorate the house, and I'd make a big meal, and I'd invite really anybody who was left behind, and we'd have kind of a Christmas dinner at my place. And this year, being 2020 and there being a pandemic, there are a lot more people than usual in that condition where they're, you know, sequestered at home, and maybe they've been isolating for, you know, 8 or 9 months. And for all the same reasons, I can't have this party that I might normally have. I can't have this dinner. So I kind of enlisted all of my, or many of my musician friends to kind of join me on this broadcast that we could just have on, and it would be on for 5 hours on Christmas Day. And anybody who's home alone or really just home and, you know, didn't have anything to do or was kind of feeling whatever, disconnected, left out, would have something real and holiday themed happening right now that they could connect with and be engaged with. And so that's really where that came from. And I'm grateful that I have so many very, very talented musical friends who are willing to join me in that effort. Because I think they made it very, very special.
Well, that's a wonderful thing for you to do.
Thank you. it felt good. It was a lot of fun.
So you live streamed it for 5 hours at different locations?
Yeah. So I'd set up just kind of like I had like a portal, and then everyone could kind of call in almost like a Zoom call. And everyone had a time slot, so they would come in and do their half hour set, and I'd introduce them, and then, you know, I would say thank you and introduce the next artist, and you know, they were all kind of streaming in from their own homes, but it was live, and you know, there were hundreds of people commenting, and you know, we could all kind of engage at least online, in a way that almost felt like a live show and almost felt like a little bit of a festival. But it was, you know, it was just a way of trying to help people feel a little bit more connected in a time when nobody's really connected.
You're involved with the Underground Music Collective. It appears to be a very supportive and interesting group. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Sure. Yeah. So that is the brainchild of one Gerard Longo. And I think it began in Lehigh Valley, where he was living at the time. And he just wanted to showcase local artists, because at the time, you know, I was the front man of a band called the New Bedfords. We were based out of New Jersey. And there were a lot of really kind of interesting punk acts, bands sort of based out of New Jersey and kind of northern Pennsylvania. And he took it upon himself to kind of show up at every tiny gig that every band that he heard about, and then, you know, kind of created a media platform around which to talk about these bands. And it's always great to find someone who just like wants to go out of their way to champion independent musicians, right? He then moved to Nashville, and then in Nashville has kind of grown his platform into just kind of a bigger and bigger thing, in terms of influence and the amount of people who are exposed to it. And now he has other collaborators, other writers who work with him, and so the Underground Music Collective has kind of grown into just a really great resource for independent artists. And he and I have just been in touch for years, right? So the New Bedfords broke up, and you know, I wasn't doing a whole lot of public work until relatively recently. But you know, the second he kind of caught wind that this record was coming, he wanted to hear it, he wanted to review it, he wanted to listen to everything, and he wanted to help us get our music out there. And so he and the rest of the folks at the Underground Music Collective are really a great resource, and I highly recommend anybody who's trying to play this game of being a musician and being a public act, look them up.
And through this, there was a live stream in October of last year. They gave you support in the making of The Last American, did they not?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So The Last American, you know, I get to put my name on it, right? Because I wrote all these songs and all of that. But there are an army of people who kind of went into helping me create it, right? First and foremost is my producer, E.W. Harris, who was also part of that holiday live stream. He's a great friend, and he was a friend long before he was my producer. But, you know, I met him in New York City in this kind of open mic scene, and then later in what we refer to as Big City Folk, which is a kind of a songwriter collective in New York City. And he became my one of my kind of great co-conspirators in making music. And he's kind of he sort of championed my songs and then was able to kind of help me build this album with the vision that we had for it. You know, there's Dan Salpaugh. He taught me how to play guitar. There's Niall Connolly, who kind of is at the center of the wheel at so many of these kind of Big City Folk events, who's always been kind of a mentor to me and also a great friend. But yeah, I found this community, and this community kind of came together for me on this album. And they keep doing it, and I adore them for it, and I'm there for them too. So,
are you still active in the collective?
Yeah. I mean, again, he runs the show, and I support him in any way that I can. And really, what he wants people like me to be doing is making music, which, you know, that's what we're trying to do. And you know, if we can sort of be a resource to other musicians, so there are kind of like private Facebook groups for musicians to kind of connect with each other and collaborate or give each other advice. And you know, I'm on those forums as well.
Well, it's a very good resource. Has it been more active since COVID hit?
Yeah, I think a lot of bands have been struggling with, you know, kind of how to reinvent their presence, their identity in a world that's all digital, right? And so there have definitely been conversations about how to do that, and you know, who's doing it well and who isn't. And then the Underground Music Collective has kind of gone out of their way to partner with venues in Nashville to create streaming shows. And, you know, they kind of converted what used to be an in-person showcase into an online showcase, which, you know, a lot of venues have taken that route. But they're just, you know, they're trying to create opportunities for smaller independent acts, and they're doing a great job.
Ali, your track, The Little Picture, a release with yourself and Ruby Landon, made the UMC 50 2020 Impactful Songs from an Impactful Year list. How did you feel about that?
Oh, wow. Yeah. So Ruby is, she's one of these, she's young. She's one of these kind of songwriters that you find in, at these open mics and song clubs in New York City. And I met her at a Big City Folk event. And she's a great guitarist, and she just has this beautiful, beautiful voice. And I'd written this song, The Little Picture, about a lot of things. But one of the things I'd written about was just a sort of like generational grief. Right, this idea that I had a lot of friends who were either becoming parents or trying to become parents or struggling with the idea that they were now parents. Right, this was the stage of life that I was in when I wrote this song, and it, you know, it's a hard thing, and I think a lot of times we don't get to acknowledge how hard a thing that is. And I'd heard Ruby singing these songs, like so many of us do, about kind of the complicated relationship that we have with our parents. And so when it came time to record this for the album, I wanted to bring her in because I think her voice is a great counterpoint to mine. It's almost the polar opposite character that her voice has relative to mine. But also I think it, like, sort of added like a different perspective, right? Like she's singing the same lyrics that I am. But because it's her voice and because of, I don't know, the way I think about her music, I think it gave the song a sort of a duality, right? Like two different perspectives being sung into the thing at the same time. And I think that was a really special track, because it's also one of the ones on the record that has the least amount of production on it, right? It's really just an acoustic guitar, our two voices, and a very, very subtle kind of electric guitar piece that sort of floats over the background, right? And that's it. Whereas there's other songs on this record that have a ton of tracks, a ton of instrumentation, and a ton of like just things kind of flying at you from different directions. And this song was just as stripped down and as naked as we could bear on this record. So from a composition point of view, I just loved being able to get her voice on there and have it mean something to me. And also, she makes a song, you know. I think it's just that much more beautiful with her on it. And for the UMC to kind of declare it as one of their 50 most impactful things, I mean, that just, I you know, this is my debut record, right? And no one has really consumed a lot of my music before now. And so to be on any kind of list like that is really, it's really moving. Right. Because, you know, the second anybody's like, oh, cool, check this out. You know, it's one thing when it's your friend, but it's another thing when someone's saying, it's like, no. In a difficult year, this is one of those songs that we turn to because it mattered to us. And so, what else could I ask for as a writer, as a musician?
Great recognition. Coming up, we're listening to the track Brave, very brooding alt folk track. Can you tell us a bit about this?
Oh, yeah. So this song, I think this is one of those songs that a lot of Muslim Americans might identify with. It's a difficult song a little bit, you know, because it's dark and it's quiet and it's, like you said, it's brooding. But it's about, you know, there was a moment in kind of public life where it felt like there was a new crisis every minute, a new disaster, a new bombing or a shooting or something. And there's this sort of terrifying reaction that Muslim Americans are kind of trained for at this point. And one is, you know, the immediate reaction to something horrible happening is, oh my God, that's horrible, right? But the second reaction that you know is happening and you don't really want to talk about is, I hope to God that whoever perpetrated this horrific thing is not a Muslim. Because the second the name comes out, my life changes again, or becomes more difficult, or so and so becomes at risk, right? And so this song was a little bit about that, the shame, you know, of that reaction, and of recognizing that I don't just get to grieve this horrible thing, that I also have to be on guard of how people react to my existence because of this horrible thing. So that was the big part of it. But the song didn't really get completed until I want to say it was 2016. Yeah, it was 2016, because that was when, you know, Donald Trump was running for president for the first time. And the DNC had a, you know, the convention happened, and a man named Khizr Khan gave a speech. And it was the first time that I can kind of remember in my life seeing anyone that looked like someone who might have been my dad or might have, you know, one of the people that I grew up with, occupying this space of American heroism. And I don't know if you remember the speech, but it was a very powerful moment. And I think a lot of Muslim Americans who were kind of conscious at that time were paid attention and saw that, and it meant a lot to them. And so the back half of the song is sort of dedicated to him and people like him.
Wow, that's an incredible depiction of what the song is about. So now we're going to listen to Brave.
Another dose of distant grief, another crisis on TV, another shot of shame that comes with every sigh of relief. And this one has nothing to do with me. And I have so much to grieve. Another someone's darkest day, another flag across my face, and a reminder the fear I've known will never go away. And this one has nothing to do with me, and I have so much to grieve. Now don't you sweat it. Some people get hurt, and that's the way it goes. Cause it takes what it takes when you want what you want, but you've won. So just let it go, dear. That's what regret is, when you know that the price is too much to pay, but you pay it anyway. Then hope that the devil won't settle the ledger today. Is it safer to be strangers? Have we been wrong all this time? Is there somewhere we can run to and live out the rest of it blind? And this one has nothing to do with me, and I have so much to grieve. Love, now don't you sweat it. Some people get hurt, and that's the way it goes. Cause it takes what it takes when you want what you want, but you've won. So just let it go, dear. That's what regret is, when you know that the price is too much to pay, but you pay it anyway. Then hope that the devil won't settle the ledger today. You were strange, with a voice that shakes from the truth of the words that we always seem to forget. Made us proud and tall for a moment at least, as you spoke what our hearts had said. Love flows like water over rocks and stones in the bed. Lose the bits that we needed the least, and you find new ways to mend. Have no regrets, and the brave have no regrets, and the brave have no regrets. So be brave.
Be honest with you, Ali, that's my favorite track in the album. Oh,
thank you so much.
I absolutely love it. Like, I was just, the minute I, 20 seconds in, I was like, oh God, I love this. Liz, let you know, both tracks are on my playlist on Spotify.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you so much. That means more to me than anything else.
Thank you. But, you know, I'm very picky about what I put on the list, and you made it, so I love it. Because I listen to it when I'm working. it's my personal playlist, so I'm not doing it for any other reason except to promote the indie and the artists I think need to be promoted. So what future projects do you have in mind after this album?
Well, you know, it's hard, right? Because we just released it, and we're still trying to get people to listen to it and discover the record and discover me. And it's a little bit, I think a lot of artists are struggling with this, right? Because we don't know what the next couple of years look like. You know, it's a bit alarming. I want a tour, you know, because I have this romantic idea about music as a, you know, as resonance, and wanting to find belonging, right? Which is so much of what this record is about. So my idea is that I should be able to play this all over this country, and wherever I find people that respond to it, I can belong there. And the more places I play it, and the more places I can belong, the more I can, you know, have some ownership over this thing that is being an American. So I'm not giving up on that. We're still going to tour, and we're still going to figure out how to do that. We just don't know when. In the more immediate future, we're trying to figure out how to do some more interesting live shows. You know, as hopefully as vaccines roll out and as case numbers go down, which isn't where they are at the moment, but hopefully, you know, that creates options for me getting the band back together and kind of doing live shows with some more instrumentation than I've been able to do in the past. So that's the sort of kind of immediate thing. And then, you know, there's already a next record, right? Like, there's songs that are going to wind up on whatever the next project is, but I'm not quite ready to commit to when that's going to be just yet. I'm not, you know, we're still in the thrust of this.
Are you going to organize any more live streams?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I think, in January, which I realize is when we're airing, I'll be announcing a more regular series of live streams, and hopefully, I think it'll be more fun for me, because the holiday stream was really, really fun, but it was also like a learning process, right? Like a way to just engage with a community that was a little bit different and not necessarily what I was expecting, but I think a lot of people enjoyed it and engaged with it in a way that was interesting. So one of those things that I used to do, you know, as a secret, was I used to host house concerts at my apartment, you know, to try and showcase other artists that I thought were brilliant. And I think the plan at the moment is to kind of set up a series of live streams where it's a little bit of that, where I'm kind of, you know, I'll be performing a set because I need to be doing that and playing this music and telling the story. And we've been crafting a show around what these songs are. But to also be able to kind of extend that platform to other people, I think is just, it's interesting, it's smart, and it lets me connect with musicians and people that I miss.
Before we go, Ali, can you tell us where best to buy, download your music?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you're welcome to stream it on Spotify, Apple Music, Tidal, Deezer, whatever your platform of choice is. If you want to buy it, you can head to Bandcamp. And all of that is accessible at my website, which is streetlightshaman.com.
Well, thank you, Ali, for joining our pod today and having a chat with me. I really enjoyed our talk, and the depth that goes into your music is just friggin' insane. I love it. I love it. I loved your music before you came on the show. I'm now like a fan. Yeah.
Thank you. It's nice to be able to dig into it a little bit, because when you write, it feels crazy when you're trying to put so much into something, because you're not sure anybody's going to hear it. But it's nice to be able to talk about it at least.
In fact, but my background is English literature. I've been a writer for 40 years. I write poetry, and I'm a songwriter as well. I have a daughter that's a poet. So I really appreciate what you do and the lyrics that you're writing and the music you're putting out. As an artist to an artist, I appreciate it's amazing.
Well, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Ali. Listeners, tune into Ali Aslam and listen to his latest tracks from the Last American album, Color of the Sun and Brave. They are out now. So thank you all for listening in today. Next episode on February the 4th, Jared Harper joins us from San Fran in the style of indie active rock, but not exclusive to. He creates pieces of work that the audience can relate to. Jared Harper is an acoustic style singer-songwriter born and raised in San Francisco. He racked up over 630,000 views on YouTube after appearing on season 18 of The Voice. Jared Harper is an upcoming artist we need to feature on the Buzzer Indie. So catch you at the pod on February the 4th, On Air Indie. From my pad to yours, over the airways. Subscribe fees are at thebuzzerpod.com. Cheers.